Hello, and welcome to the Winter 2008 podcast for the journal Pediatric Physical Therapy. I'm Donovan Stutel. This month, perspectives on EBP from school-based pediatric PTs, adaptive seating effectiveness in children with CP, and more. This podcast is brought to you by the Section on Pediatrics of the American Physical Therapy Association. The section seeks to promote the highest quality of life for all children, people with developmental disabilities, and their families. First this month, editor Anne Van Sant with her editorial, Listening.
Some of the most important information we obtained is gained from listening to our colleagues. In this issue, Schreiber presents the results of a qualitative research study exploring the barriers to incorporating research evidence into practice among a group of pediatric therapists working in school settings. As a profession, we've embraced the idea of evidence-based practice, but we have yet to fully face and solve the problems that prevent practitioners from incorporating evidence into what they do. I recommend that we all read Schreiber's report and listen carefully to the voices of our colleagues. Listening is the very first step. First and foremost, I heard practitioners speaking of their time constraints. All were practicing on a part-time basis. The realities of time constraints associated with these practice patterns should bring us to some understanding of the need to recognize the context in which our colleagues are practicing. I envision busy professionals balancing work and family responsibilities. Time is a precious commodity that must be spent wisely and with efficiency. Any attempts to improve practitioners' exposure to evidence that would guide their practice should respect the limitations of time and provide lasting value for the time spent. Those who have the luxury of working in academic or in large practice settings that provide ready access to professional and scientific journals have a decided advantage over those who are working in settings where such access is not the norm. Listening to the voices of those who cannot get to the information that should be guiding their practice reinforces in my mind how membership in the APTA provides a distinct advantage to those who would use evidence to guide their practice. Why is it that individuals choose not to join APTA, particularly when they understand the advantages of membership? Is it a financial issue, or is it a matter of priorities? We need to listen and then encourage our colleagues to make the necessary sacrifices that enable them to access support for their own professional development. In the voices of the participants in Schreiber's study, you can hear the cry for more training to prepare practitioners to critique professional literature. It is one thing to read a research article. It's another thing to be able to identify the strengths and weaknesses in the published studies and come to one's own conclusion about a clinical bottom line. Are we listening? Students in professional education programs are being exposed to the standards against which research on interventions should be judged. But becoming skilled at exercising such judgment takes time, practice, and mentoring. Did you hear the voices speaking of their need to interact with a senior therapist to promote development of their skill? Finally, in the report, I heard the voices of those practicing in a school system. Evidence-based practice is not unique to medical practitioners or to more medically-based practice settings. The need for teachers to incorporate the results of research into their educational practices is just as important as the demand for evidence-based practice in health-related settings. So for me, the setting should not matter. I also heard the voices indicate that evidence-based practice does not influence reimbursement for services. But we do need to advocate for using evidence where it exists to assure that children are receiving the most effective interventions we have to offer, regardless of the direct effect on reimbursement. We need to hear the voices of our colleagues, those who are in public school settings, those who work full-time, those who work part-time, and those working in other types of practice settings. They can identify the barriers to evidence-based practice, and then we need to provide professional development for evidence-based practice in the most efficient and effective ways possible. Shriver reports on innovative practices that are beginning to be shown to be effective ways to provide support to medical practitioners. We should listen and learn from this. In large measure, practical experience guides practice, but evidence, despite being documented to play a more limited role in clinical decision-making, has an increasingly important part to play in how we treat children. In most clinical research reports, one can find the clinical question that drove the investigators to conduct their study. Their experiences caused them to ask the question, and then they took the time and made the sacrifice to expend the effort to conduct research to find answers to their questions. We can learn from others' experience by both listening to questions researchers are asking and then listening to the evidence they bring to bear on the question.
School-based pediatric physical therapists' perspectives on evidence-based practice by Joe Shriver of Duquesne University and Chatham University, both in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and Perry Stern, Gregory Marchetti, Ingrid Provident, and Paula Samarone-Tarossi. Purpose: this study described the current knowledge, beliefs, attitudes, and practices of a group of school-based pediatric physical therapists regarding evidence-based practice, EBP. Methods: 5 practitioners participated in this project. Each was interviewed individually and in a group and completed a quantitative survey. Results: all of the participants had a positive attitude toward EBP and believed that it should be an important element of clinical practice. Knowledge and practice were more variable, with several individuals reporting a lack of confidence in this area and an inability to routinely implement EBP. Conclusions: to aid in decision-making, these participants were more likely to rely on colleagues, interaction with their supervisor, and professional experience, and less likely to rely on research evidence. Pediatric physical therapists face numerous challenges accessing, analyzing, and applying research evidence. It is critical for the profession to identify optimal ways to support practitioners in this aspect of clinical practice. That was School-Based Pediatric Physical Therapists' Perspectives on Evidence-Based Practice by Shriver et al. Next, effectiveness of adaptive seating on sitting posture and postural control in children with cerebral palsy by Julie Chung of the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, and 6 others. Purpose: we reviewed research on the effect of adaptive seating on sitting posture and postural control in children with cerebral palsy. Second, we examined whether changes in postural control related to changes in other aspects of functioning. Methods: electronic database and hand searches were undertaken to locate studies published in English. Reviewers screened studies for inclusion criteria, extracted data, indexed outcomes to the International Classification of Functioning Disability and Health, assigned levels of evidence, and assessed study quality. Results: 13 of 14 articles used group designs and the other a single subject design. Conflicting findings were reported for saddle seats and optimal seat and back angle for improving sitting posture or postural control. Significant improvements were reported with seat inserts, external supports, and modular seating systems. There was limited evidence supporting effects of postural control on functional abilities. Conclusions: future studies on the effects of adaptive seating should describe participants with standardized classification systems and employ stronger research designs. That was effectiveness of adaptive seating on sitting posture and postural control in children with cerebral palsy by Chung et al. Systematic review of progressive strength training in children and adolescents with cerebral palsy who are ambulatory by Margaret Mockford of North Staffordshire NHS Primary Care Trust and Jeanette Calton of Keele University, both in Staffordshire, United Kingdom. Purpose: to capture and analyze the evidence concerning the effects of progressive strength training on function and gait in children and adolescents with cerebral palsy, CP, who are ambulatory. Method. A language-inclusive search was conducted for controlled or non-controlled studies of strength training for subjects with CP who are ambulatory and aged 4 to 20 years, using objective outcome measures. Quality was assessed with the Maastricht-Amsterdam list. Data were extracted and analyzed. Results. The 13 included articles favored treatment without significant adverse effects. Function and gait improved more following isotonic rather than isokinetic training and in younger rather than older subjects. Conclusions. Function and gait improvements were greater in pre-adolescence. That was Systematic Review of Progressive Strength Training in Children and Adolescents with Cerebral Palsy Who Are Ambulatory by Mockford and Calton. Next, do therapists' goals and interventions for children with cerebral palsy reflect principles in contemporary literature? By Johanna Dara, Leslie Weirt, and Joyce McGill-Evans, all of the University of Alberta in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Purpose: to explore therapists' goal setting and intervention with children with cerebral palsy and to examine their acceptance of children's use of compensatory movement strategies. Methods: interviews were conducted with 23 occupational therapists and 31 physical therapists. Goals and assumptions of relationships between intervention approaches and expected outcomes were coded using the International Classification of Functioning, Disability, and Health, ICF. Therapists' acceptance of compensatory movement strategies was rated. Results: 33 therapists identified goals representing the ICF activity component. Therapists working with younger children identified goals representing the ICF body function structure component. 24 therapists assumed that an intervention targeted at one ICF component would affect an outcome in a different component. 11 therapists would not accept compensatory movement strategies. Conclusions: most therapists' goals are congruent with principles encouraging functional goals. The ICF matrix developed for this study may be useful for clinical evaluation and documentation of assumed relationships among interventions and outcomes. That was, do therapists' goals and interventions for children with cerebral palsy reflect principles in contemporary literature? By Dara, Weirt, and McGill-Evans. Motor performance of infants born small or appropriate for gestational age, a comparative study. By Denise Campos of the State University of Campinas, Sao Paulo State, Brazil, and Denise Santos, Vanda Maria Gonçalves, Mara Goto, and Tatiane Campos Zanelli. Purpose: to compare the motor performance of infants born small for gestational age with those appropriate for gestational age at 1, 2, 3, and 6 months. Methods: a prospective cross-sectional study was conducted using infants born full term with birth weight under the 10th percentile for the small for gestational age group and between the 10th and 90th percentiles for the appropriate for gestational age group. The motor scale of Bailey Scales of Infant Development 2 was used to document motor performance. Results: the small for gestational age group presented with a mean motor index score lower than the appropriate for gestational age group at 2 and 6 months, with the small for gestational age group presenting fewer infants that successfully accomplished making crawling movements, turns from side to back, balances head, sits alone momentarily, and sits alone for 30 seconds. Conclusions: data analysis suggested that infants who are small for gestational age presented greater risk of adverse outcomes that are detectable in motor performance measures at 2 months. That was, motor performance of infants born small or appropriate for gestational age a comparative study by Campos et al. Next, effects of backpack carriage on gait parameters in children by Barbara Connolly of the University of Tennessee Health Science Center in Memphis, Tennessee, and six others. Purpose: carrying a backpack over two shoulders is the most efficient means of carriage, but often backpacks are carried over one shoulder. Our purpose was to assess walking base of support, stride length, double support time, and velocity when backpacks were carried on one or two shoulders. Methods: 32 children aged 12 to 13 years were assessed under two load conditions using the Gaitright system. Results: when the loaded walk conditions were compared with the unloaded baseline walk, no significant differences were found in base of support, stride length, or velocity. Double limb support significantly increased with both load conditions when compared with the baseline, but there was no difference between one shoulder and two shoulders carriage. Conclusion: with loads limited to 15% of body weight, little change in temporal-spatial gait parameters was noted during backpack use. Future studies need to examine the effects of the child's height, body mass index, and strength on safe backpack use. That was Effects of Backpack Carriage on Gait Parameters in Children by Connolly et al. Next, using cognitive interviewing for test items to assess physical function in children with cerebral palsy by Helene Dumas of Franciscan Hospital for Children in Boston, Massachusetts, and eight others. Purpose: the purpose of this study was to assess the content, format, and comprehension of test items and responses developed for use in a computer adaptive test of physical function for children with cerebral palsy. Methods: after training in cognitive interviewing techniques, investigators defined item intent and developed questions for each item. 27 parents of children with cerebral palsy participated in interviews probing item meaning, item wording, and response choice adequacy and appropriateness. Results: quantitative analysis identified three themes: item clarity, relevance, context, and attribution, and problems with wording or tone. Parents reported the importance of delineating task components, assistance amount, and environmental context. Conclusion: cognitive interviewing provided valuable information about the validity of new items and insight to improve relevance and context. We believe that the development of computer adaptive tests in pediatric rehabilitation may ultimately reduce the impact of the issues identified. That was Using Cognitive Interviewing for Test Items to Assess Physical Function in Children with Cerebral Palsy by Dumas et al. Parent Preferences for Motor Development Education in the Neonatal Intensive Care Unit by Stacy Dusing, Teresa Murray, and Marilyn Stern, all of Virginia Commonwealth University in Richmond, Virginia. Purpose: the purpose of this pilot study was to determine parents' preferred method of receiving education on motor development of infants born preterm. Methods: this study was conducted through a pair of focus groups in which parents evaluated different educational formats and provided feedback on the clarity of the parent education intervention. Results: parents reported that they would prefer to learn about their infant's motor development with a combination of observation, discussion, and written material. After the parent education intervention, parents of infants born preterm were able to describe the ways they would play with their infant and answered more questions correctly on a post-intervention test. Conclusions: parents of infants who were born preterm would benefit from education using multiple approaches. The parent education intervention developed in this study is clear and well understood by parents. Further research is needed to evaluate the efficacy of this intervention. That was Parent Preferences for Motor Development Education in the Neonatal Intensive Care Unit by Dusing, Murray, and Stern. Last this month, Intrarater Range of Motion Reliability in Cerebral Palsy, a Comparison of Assessment Methods by Alan Glansman, Amy Swenson, and Hee Kyung Kim, all of the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Purpose: to compare intrarater reliability of goniometry performed with and without an assistant, and to compare the reliability of the Staheli and Thomas tests of hip extension. Visual estimation was also evaluated as a method of range of motion assessment. Methods: both the right and left legs of 25 children with cerebral palsy were evaluated in a blind fashion. Results: intraclass correlations, ICCs, ranged for one-person goniometry from 0.970 to 0.980, and for two-person goniometry, ranged from 0.967 to 0.982. For visual estimation, Pearson product moment correlations ranged from 0.89 to 0.96. Staheli and Thomas test ICCs were 0.979 and 0.980, respectively. Conclusions: goniometry with one and two assessors both produced ICCs in the excellent range, as did the Staheli and Thomas test measurement of hip extension. The use of an assistant did not provide additional benefit. Visual estimation showed excellent correlation with goniometry. That was Intrarater Range of Motion Reliability in Cerebral Palsy, a Comparison of Assessment Methods, by Glansman, Swenson, and Kim. This podcast is a production of Science Audio, online at www.scienceaudio.net. We welcome your questions or comments about this podcast. Give us your feedback at PEDPT, that's P-E-D-P-T, at scienceaudio.net. Get the full text of all pediatric physical therapy articles online at www.pedpt.com. Thanks for listening.